case, the United States versus Hosking. Mr. Loeb.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Jordan Loeb. I'm here to present on behalf of Gene Hosking. There are really two issues for the court this morning that were raised by Ms. Hosking on appeal. First is determining the appropriate amount of restitution, and secondly, addressing the lump sum payment ordered by the court, which essentially required liquidation of her retirement account. The central issue in determining the appropriate amount of restitution is the starting point, that is, the victim giving a complete accounting of the losses that they claim. And in this case, Ms. Hosking's central challenge is that a complete accounting was not made. What the victim did through the pre-sentence investigation and ultimately through the government's argument at sentencing was give a laundry list of expenses they would like to recover. And I think I'm being generous, actually, by identifying them as expenses, because really what the victim did was give a laundry list of money that they wanted back. And the court worked its way through that list by asking the questions, and when there were no answers available for the government, items were tossed. What started to become clear is that the bank was asking for money that they had already recovered from their insurance company. Well, you can't get the money twice. It's already part of the restitution that the insurance company is going to be able to.
Here's my problem. If the in-house staff expenses covered the accounting for both the criminal and the civil cases, why is it unreasonable to just split the expenses in half and order restitution for half? I mean, this case could take like another year to figure out. If you, you know, start deeply into it. And after all, it is she that has caused this problem.
I will start with that last point. I do not deny the fact that it is Ms. Hosking that caused the problem. But we have to quantify the problem at some point. What the code tells us is we need a complete accounting of these losses. And what the bank did was throw some numbers. It wasn't a matter of saying we've identified the appropriate amount of staff costs, but we're going to split it between a civil and a criminal case. There was not nearly that kind of formulaic assessment of the numbers the bank presented. What Judge Crabb recognized was that this was an estimate of staff expenses. We don't have an account, and we don't know who did what, when, or why. We just have...
Well, didn't they just report the person that they were reporting on and the number of hours spent, and they didn't tell you what they did or why they did it? Or
that's exactly my point, Your Honor. They just identified we want payment of X amount of money for the time this person spent, and we're supposed to take it on faith that that's an accurate statement, not only of the time that they spent, but that time was an expense caused by the defendant's criminal behavior. And
well, we don't know what they did we? I mean,
I don't. The court sure doesn't. So, again, my point is we're taking it on faith that not only was this time spent, but it was spent as a result of the criminal behavior of Ms. Hosking. So long before we can get to the point of whether it's appropriate to just split that amount of money in half, we have to ask, what is that amount of money for? How is it spent? Without that careful scrutiny, essentially what we're encouraging victims to do is shoot for the moon when they make a restitution request. Maybe it'll get cut in half, but you'll get your restitution request. We see that in civil cases when people file an insurance claim. They put in everything they can dream of and hope that the insurance adjuster either isn't paying careful attention or just split the difference with them. Splitting the difference is not a very careful way to scrutinize a restitution request. There is an evidentiary standard. It's the preponderance of the evidence. So there is a burden of proof here. There is a burden of production. It isn't simply making a request and the court exercising discretion whether the request is reasonable.
You know, you didn't respond to the government's argument that the plea agreement gave the district court more discretion than it would have otherwise have had to determine the amount for the loss caused by her conduct. You want to respond to
it? Sure. I'll take this moment to respond to it. I don't think it really changes the assessment. Maybe the court has more discretion in what it considers to be a loss. That's fine, but we're still at the starting point with the burden of producing evidence of what that loss was. We have to start at the beginning. What are the actual numbers? Without this complete accounting, which is called for by the code, we can't get into whether the court was exercising its discretion appropriately because we don't know what these numbers are. We're basically starting in the middle and arguing rationally forward. Well, we can't do that because we're not starting on a proper foundation. And every claim for damages, whether it be civil or restitution in a criminal case, we have to start with accurate numbers.
Now, of course, if we send it back for the court and the government to sort all this out, her part could conceivably come out to more than half of the in-house staff expense, couldn't it?
It certainly could. It certainly could. And as a practical matter, probably all of this is an academic point because, as the court found, there's no realistic possibility, given Ms. Hosking's age and likely income, that she's going to be able to pay all of the restitution back. After all, the major portion of restitution is $502,000. So why bother? Justice, I think, requires that we get at this with the proper process and come out with the proper result, even if in the end it doesn't make a difference in terms of how much restitution is actually paid. There's a process here, and it's just uncomfortable to address it from the standpoint of, well, we walk into court, and if the government asks for it on behalf of a victim, it's simply given.
You know, I don't know. This is not an easy question because you'd have to have – I mean, it's like punishing the victim a second time. Now you have to figure out what this embezzler, you know, was doing there. On top of being embezzled –
I don't want to be flippant in my response in terms of punishing a victim, but, you know, I track my time in six-minute increments. Most professionals do track their times on some level or another. You know, ironically, probably part of what contributed to Ms. Hosking's ability to be able to be involved in this scheme and to such an extent over such a period of time is the bank's failure to keep careful records and do the things that probably FDIC should be requiring them to do in the first place.
Because they were foolish enough to trust this woman.
Trust but confirm, trust but supervise. I'm aware that there, in most financial situations, there are checks on the system. You're right. It is not their fault that she stole from them. But it is a bank, it is a professional institution, and I don't think it's too much to ask that if they're asking for restitution, the equivalent of damages as a result of Ms. Hosking's loss, that they simply track those, that they simply be able to back up their numbers with something other than what really looks like an estimate, by all accounts. It looks like just round numbers. We think our staff spent this amount of time, and round numbers, we think it's worth this amount of time. We don't even know what their salaries were. Part of it is, I would note, and I'm going to save the rest of my time for rebuttal, part of the economic loss, the lost wages that the bank has, is just a number, 20% for fringes. I'm left to wonder what that is. Really, the court needs more than that to make a good finding by the preponderance.
Thank you, Mr. Loeb. Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess initially I'd like to back up and just run through the sequence of events in this case because it's not quite as counsel presented it. It wasn't quite as flippant through the system. To start out with, it's a very, very complex case. When the court looks at the government's submissions to the sentencing memorandum, this was a lady who was a vice president of the bank. She was responsible for a very complicated loan system that was different than any other system in the bank. And the only reason she was responsible for it because she and her husband had bought a gas station 20 years before that, and she had gotten this type of loan, and then the bank got interested in this because they could make some money. So she started administering what they called the PECFA loans, which were grants based upon loans, or they were loans to clean up gas stations, those types of environmental problems. And the bank was responsible for the bookkeeping. A very odd situation, but they were responsible for the bookkeeping. They would submit invoices to the State Department of Administration, and then they would reimburse them. There were 23 loans involved with this. It ran over a period of 12 years, and there were literally hundreds of transactions.
But what basis is there in the record for splitting the in-house costs in half? How do we know what portion of the time was spent on criminal versus civil matters, or how much time was spent on training? It just seems so arbitrary. You know, that in-house staff expense included the expense of training employees to understand PECFA. How can that be considered a direct result of her fraud, training employees?
Because without those items, they never would have been able to reconstruct the case.
There isn't any information on the records, though. They don't tell you what they did. They tell you how much time they spent, but they don't tell you what they did or why they did it.
I think
that's a very adequate record.
That's correct. The record contains approximately 50 pages of documentation from the bank relating to their costs. The employee costs were summarized by employee. And again, when you look back at the original documents that describe the scheme and describe what these employees had to do, as Judge Crabb said, I just don't think it's unreasonable to take half of that. I mean, they had to have spent half of that. These people worked on that for a long period of time. Some of them worked on it for almost a year, putting these transactions back together again. I think Judge Crabb recognized the fact that there wasn't as much detail as should be there. But when she looked at the entire record, all the documents that were provided, she simply concluded, and I don't think it was an abuse of discretion, that they had to be there.
You know, there seemed to be a few points during the sentencing where she asks a question about the numbers, and the government says, well, those are the numbers the bank gave us. I can't explain them further. Did the government conduct any independent investigation into the numbers presented by the bank, or did the government simply pass on to the court the numbers that the bank presented to the government?
No, I did not conduct any independent investigation. I took the numbers that the bank submitted to me. It's a two-step process. The bank submitted a document. It's the form of a declaration to probation and parole outlining all of their expenses. I then took that declaration and excluded from the declaration things that I didn't believe were appropriate, and then submitted my recommendation to the court in the sentencing memorandum. And then the court went through that sentencing memorandum, particularly with attorney's fees and with the accounting fees. And I think it's interesting to note the exchange between defense counsel and the court relating to the accounting fees and the attorney's fees.
Well, we're setting a precedent here of what we're going to require in this kind of a restitution case. And that's what disturbs me. You know, if we just say, well, we'll accept anything you give us as long as you cut it in half, that's going to be an interesting precedent.
I understand that, sir, and I agree with you 100%, but I think you have to look at go back at the facts of this particular case. I mean, you can
but
look
they're
at
some, also complicated. I mean, this is, happens to be a very small bank. I mean, just imagine if it were Bank of America and we're sitting here.
Judge, I've been doing this for 33 years, and this is probably the single most complicated bank fraud case, embezzlement case I've seen. I mean, it ran over such a long period of time, and when you look, there's one document in the government's sentencing memorandum, one document from the bank that describes the overlapping procedures, the things that she went through to cover it up, through creation of a second loan and then paying back loans all the way through it. I mean, this was something that took that type of investigation. It took attorney help in the beginning, it took accounting help, and then it took staffers just simply sitting down trying to go through it. I have nothing further unless there's any additional questions.
Well, yeah, I do. I mean, why is it that the victim bank is the only entity that could have conducted the investigation? the fact that the bank staff had to be trained to conduct the investigation suggests that they were not the best equipped entity to do this. Don't normally, who does it? Your FBI agents, your paralegals? Who normally does this stuff in your district? You?
Post 9/11, I do it. We don't simply don't have the resources, honestly, to do it.
Yeah.
In this case, had the bank not done what they did, I would have been left with the $135,000 loss that she admitted, and I would obviously had to substantiate that. But she did admit that. We would have substantiated that as best we could, and we would have moved on, unfortunately.
And then what would have her, what would her sentence have been?
Her sentence would have been less than the $500,000, I think, moved it over a range, so it would have been less than that, a few months less than that, down a range.
The other thing I was interested in was, could the court order her to begin taking her Social Security payments at age 62 so that she could start making periodic restitution payments?
When she's released, she would start making periodic restitution payments based upon, you know, whatever her income is at the
now,
time.
See, in other words, I'm wondering how, if the court said, look, you're going to have to start taking Social Security at 62, because, in other words, what I was wondering was how that would differ from liquidating the IRA. What's the statutory authority for ordering the IRA liquidated?
It's found in the collection, the federal collection statute 3663. It requires that it provides that any court order becomes a lien similar to a tax lien. And then when you follow on down through that statute, there's a section of it which is, should I get the phrase right? It's called notwithstanding, and it specifically says this functions as a lien notwithstanding any other federal statute.
Okay.
And that's the authority.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Johnson, does that $100,000 come before the IRS?
What?
Does that $100,000 come before the IRS takes its tax?
Absolutely. We're tough on collection. Thank you.
Mr. Lowe.
Thank you. I know my time is limited, so I'll try to speak as quickly as Mr. Shapiro did.
Good luck.
Thank you. One, I would dispute the semantics chosen by the government on this. It wasn't a complex case for the government. Ms. Hosking pled to a one-count information where we had agreed on the loss after the loss was determined through whatever accounting process was done. The government
but
did a good.
She said it was $135,000.
She did not say that to the government. When she was confronted by her employer about how much she thought the loss was, she estimated it to be $135,000 or thereabouts. Not accurate, but not inconsistent with people who embezzle, unfortunately.
You're not challenging the $502,000.
No, in fact, we agreed to that and waived indictment and agreed to that number. It really isn't about the largest portion of the restitution. It's about what are these add-on losses that wouldn't traditionally be restitution, but probably more appropriately called expenses or other losses by the victim. The government also refers to 50 pages of documentation. In fact, these in-house staff costs amount to less than one page of documentation. Most of those 50 pages were tossed out by the court. I see that my time is up, so I will.
You can make a concluding remark, so.
Really, my conclusion is this. We should have more to rely upon when making these decisions than simply the government's assertion that the time was spent or that this is an accurate number. If challenged, the government should come forward with something to back up their numbers so that we can make.
Can we justify Mr. Johnson's time? He represented that he had to do much of the work.
No, we can't. I'm aware that the law does not allow reimbursement of that. Nor yours, unfortunately, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lowe. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. The case is taken under advisement.